You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
The experience of crossing a great cultural divide haunts the fiction of Chang Rae Lee. That's not surprising, perhaps, when you consider that he emigrated from Korea at age 3. Lee's debut novel, Native Speaker, was about a Korean-American outsider who becomes involved in espionage. That novel garnered numerous awards, and Lee was later named one of the 20 best American writers by the New Yorker magazine for his second novel, Adjust Your Life, the tale of a medic who recalls his experience of treating Korean comfort women during World War II. His other novels include Aloft and The Surrendered, which was a finalist for the 2011 Pulitzer Prize. In Chang Rae Lee's new novel, On Such a Full Sea, which he and Charles Yu will discuss tonight, he imagines a future after the breakdown of our own society. In this dystopia, however, there are no robots or cannibals. His novel takes place in an almost familiar world, one whose cities were long ago rendered unlivable by polluted air and water, forcing whole societies to relocate. Lee fully imagines the world of his young protagonist, Fan, the fish tank diver, at the center of his story. We follow Fan's odyssey from the regimented world of her compound in Beemore into the dangerous open counties in search of her missing boyfriend. In conversation tonight with Chang Rae Lee, we're delighted to welcome the story-bending novelist Charles Yu, author of Sorry, Please, Thank You, and How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe, the story of a son searching for his father through quantum space-time. Charles received the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Award for his story collection, Third Class Superhero. Please welcome Chang Rae Lee and Charles Yu to the Aloud stage at the Los Angeles Public Library.
Hello.
Hey.
Hello.
Hey.
Good evening.
Look at all these people.
All for you.
No, they came for you.
It is a pleasure and an honor to be here. Thanks, Maureen, for that lovely introduction. Let me steady myself. It's really great to be sitting across from you. Thanks for coming here.
Great to meet you, Charlie.
Yeah.
Really great. I just read Charlie's last novel. It's such a beautiful. If you haven't read that book, it's a beautiful book. You know, it's. When you said that you had studied poetry, it made sense to me, because there's, you know, the book is of course about certain things, but it, for me, it's always in the how, right, and how it's written that's exciting. So
I appreciate you saying that. I am trying to somehow find a way to record this so I can show it to my parents, because. That moment there was kind of a career highlight for me, so you should all try to write novels so that you can sit across the way someday from someone like Chang Rae Lee who can then say things that melt you. So I will try now to move on from that moment. Okay, so we talked a little bit just briefly now, before about this book, and my first, just to dive right in, my first reaction is, reading, the reviews before, before you get a chance to read the book, it's, oh my God, Chang Rae Lee wrote a dystopian novel. Oh my God, Chang Rae Lee wrote dystopia, what? And yes, you did. At the same time, I want to sort of venture the thesis that, I mean, that's an easy label for it. And yet, this is, okay, so let me back up half a step. This is a rigidly stratified society that has sort of upper, middle, and lower classes socioeconomically. It's set in an America where it's very hard to move around within classes, if not impossible. Described that way, it doesn't sound like science fiction. It has a quality of dystopia, of what I consider any good dystopia, isn't in that it sounds both preposterous and yet more like your real life than most realism. You know, you really, so having said all that, how did you come to write dystopia? Do you think of it that way?
No, I mean, I never did in conception. You know, it was, I always call it an accidental dystopian novel. Really, I was interested in talking about communities. And to talk about the central community of Beemore, which is where the heroine comes from, mm-hmm. And this production facility. I found that I had to set it in, I would say, you know, what everyone would say is a speculative landscape. Mm-hmm. But again, as you mentioned, it was a landscape that for me was very near to all of my worries and anxieties and kind of desires for, you know, how our society mm-hmm. should be, you know, or shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And so really it was, you know, if anything, it's two other things besides being a dystopian novel. And again, I never had that label in my head because, again, it is the easiest way to describe it. You know, that's how, you know, a television producer would describe mm-hmm. it and see it. But the actual, the essence of it for me is, I think, in two parts. One, it's a community, a sort of a, I would say, an experimental immigrant novel. Mm. And then the other part of it is it's a novel about storytelling. That because the novel is told in a somewhat unusual way, it's told by a plural narrator, the we. And I think if the more that you read this we, certainly for me, the more, you know, as I began to write it, I began to get very interested in how this we was formulating the world, of course, but more importantly, how it engaged with the story it was telling. And that for me is, you know, probably the primary aesthetic urge that I had to write a legend, but also to talk about writing a mm-hmm, legend and mm-hmm. to ask why do these people need to have this legend? Mm-hmm. Because people always ask me, you know, the first question people ask is, why didn't you just have the heroine tell her story? Mm-hmm. Which would be the simplest thing to do. I did this, I did that. And I had to say very, from the first moment of the story, she's not the center of the story. Right. She's the center of the action sometimes. Mm-hmm. But she's actually not the center of the story.
Right, so the we, the we was... the most fascinating part of it for me, you know, as a novelist and as a reader, but I think especially as someone who has tried to sustain other people's attention for several hundred pages, or even a couple hundred, and also sustain my own. And so when I realized, you know, being a little slow, it took me a few chapters to realize it, but as I realized what the we was, how incredible it was, it dawned on me that this was the kind of thing that could easily sustain, you know, my interest if I had come up with it. I wish I had. It's what I like to call, this is a little bit of a strained analogy, but like silver-plated gold, because at first you find it and you're like, oh, that's silver, that's very valuable. And then you get underneath it and you're like, oh, it's better than silver. Because, so the we, just again, to back up half a step, is the point of view through which the story's told. And correct me if I'm wrong, at times it seems to expand and contract as necessary to the point where if you're reading carefully, you realize it's sort of, if not breaking, it's playing very sort of in a very clever way with its point of view to whatever the story needs at that moment. Its level of omniscience seems to change at times. And so, and you already touched on it a bit, so I'm not sure I can expand on it other than to gush about what a great device it was, but did you have a story here before that we, or was the we kind of part of the seed of it?
It was part of the seed of it. because I tried to think about this community. And in the book, for those of you who don't know anything about the book, this community was brought over en masse. The originals, as they called them, were brought over en masse 100 years before, and these are the descendants of those people from China. Mm-hmm. And so I was primarily interested in how inside a very regulated cloistered space, and a really strict cloister, how that community would then develop, how it would think of itself, how it would regulate itself, the kinds of morality and interests it would have. Mm-hmm. And instead of a typical immigrant novel, which is all about kind of cross-fertilization, right? But this community is left to its own devices. But of course, tasked to provide a service as well. And so those two things for me was what was driving this community and what I was interested in. And I guess from the very start, I was curious about how a consciousness would then emerge in that community. What would the shape of that consciousness be? So instead of picking one person from that community and having him or her be representative of it, which I felt wouldn't be quite right, I mean, because no one person is ever representative. I mean, I'm sure we get asked this question all the time, right, of a community. Mm-hmm. You can't be, right? You and I are Asian and Asian American in very different ways, mm-hmm. presumably. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to, as you say, I liked how you said contracted and expanded. You know, the we would sometimes be, you know, advocating something. Sometimes it would be moralizing. Sometimes it would be, you know, involved in conjecture about what this fan would do. Sometimes it's straight sort of wishful thinking about what she did. Sometimes I think I push it to the extent that maybe it's just creating what fan does out there, not reporting it. Mm-hmm. And that for me was something that I didn't quite anticipate, I mean, to be honest. But once I decided that I wouldn't allow the we to be monolithic, it gave me a lot of freedom. But then it also, again, fed into a lot of my interests in terms of, you know, how do these stories come about? How do these legends come about? It's not just one source. You know, any legend that comes down to us, we are constantly in the process of revising it, adding to it, taking it away, editing it, you know, And so this we is a kind of compendium of all the stories about Fan, and at certain moments contradictory and even ignorant. Mm.
Talking about Fan a little bit in a little more detail, she has an unusual, well, not unusual, she has a made-up job because this is an imagined speculative society. Can you talk a bit about the job she has and how you came about creating that?
Well, I wondered what this, you know, this was, this her community is, the function of the community is to produce foodstuffs for the elite charter class of people. And so I just asked myself, well, what do they produce? And so I decided, well, they do fish farming, indoor fish farming, because the environment is so messed up that you wouldn't ever have anything outside. And so I thought, and I did a little research into indoor fish farming, and then I realized that, you know, you could also grow vegetables above the tanks, and it would sort of all be a system or something like that. And I like the idea then, and this is how, it's funny how, and I don't know if this is the case with you, Charlie, but you decide something, say, yeah, she's a fish farmer, you know, she cleans the tanks and does all that. But then the object of that then, which you would think is just, you know, a detail of her occupation, can become something much greater than that. You know, it can have a certain kind of metaphorical energy, right?
Yes.
And once I realized that she was in the tanks with all these fish, you know, I realized that, well, that's a perfect mirror of what her whole society is. You know, they're kind of in this aquarium, in this regulated, engineered space,
right,
where they're all taken care of, but in some ways also consumed.
Right.
It worked. And again, maybe I subconsciously knew all that, but once you, and I think that's somehow sometimes how you find your subject.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you maybe subconsciously know things, and then you make them apparent. To sort of teach yourself about what you already know.
Right.
Which is a funny way to, I don't know what, you know, it's not a really great way to write, I think. But but I think that's, but, you know, I say that also facetiously. I think it's maybe the only way to write, mm-hmm. too. Because you're, I don't know, how do you feel about it?
Well, I think, and what I had compared it to was, it took me a while to realize how this had organically worked. Exactly as described, the metaphor starts to spread until almost everything in it starts to get these connections. And you almost, everywhere you look, you see this happening. I mean, I think of something like elevator inspectors in The Intuitionist, in right. Colson Whitehead's The Intuitionist, or in Don DeLillo's White Noise, Professor Gladney is a professor of Hitler studies, I think, right? And so you have these metaphors. That one maybe not as on point, but
well, the toxic cloud.
The toxic cloud, right, yeah.
Right.
These kind of metaphors that, especially with a job, can do so much work in describing the society. Because as you alluded, you know, Fan works in these contained tanks of aquaculture and fish culture. You have the metaphor of a container, and then you've got these contained classes and then charter villages. And so without having to belabor the point, the novel has this beautiful structure, you know, sort of metaphorically, that works also well within the level of the story. So.
Yeah, and one of the, as you mentioned, I mean, one of the things I'm interested in this novel is about the rigid divides between these classes and kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that all these people are in some ways trapped in their own, you know, in their own soup. You know, mm-hmm. Whether that soup is wonderful or not, luxurious or not, doesn't matter. They're still trapped there. So that the people who have everything are, you know, they're made crazy by all their things, all their material wealth, and they become grotesque.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something that, again, you know, and people always ask me, you know, did you figure all this out? And no, you can't figure all this out. And particularly in this story, which is in another way kind of structured as an adventure tale, you know, kind of a right. quest tale, where in each episode she's basically going out and, you know, meeting a creature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes they're people, sometimes they're... and so part of my interest there too, and just to have fun as a writer, was just to start each chapter not really knowing where she would go or whom she would meet.
Mm.
And that's kind of scary again, but I kind of got into the whole kind of rhythm of that.
Mm-hmm.
And in a nice way. But of course, you know, you try to keep in mind all the things you've already laid down. You know, it's sort of like a, you know, I don't know, maybe it's some sort of musical analogy, but there's certain kind of things that you lay down that you want to, if not repeat, but complement somehow.
Yeah.
As you move forward.
Yeah, you find. Well, I don't. I'm not. I was going to try to make a musical analogy. That was going to end in disaster, so I'll just stop right there. So Fan, so I guess. That kind of segues nicely into Fan's journey, I guess, no spoilers, because hopefully, you know, if you haven't read it, you will be reading it, you know, tonight, and then we'll come back tomorrow for the follow-up discussion. That is not actually happening, sorry.
You could be back. I'm going.
Yeah,
right.
I will lead a discussion home. Group tomorrow outside Fifth and Flower. Fan is in Beemore, and... again, I won't give away anything, but she does, through the course of the story, move through various... She gets to see the different strata of the society. And it brings up kind of two thoughts that were interesting to me. I hope they're interesting to other people, specifically all of these people. The one is the idea of the barriers between these strata, because they seem to be incredibly impenetrable and yet somewhat invisible. It's not as if there are like armed guards. Well, correct me if I'm wrong factually, but it's not as if. And where I'm leading with this is that I loved the way it was a distillation of the kind of invisible barriers between socioeconomic classes in this America.
Right.
I mean, it was really resonant for me, and I would love for to hear if that what all is something you were thinking about.
Well, there it isn't. I think you're right. It's not policed in the way that, say, a place would be policed, but the barriers are more ingrained in the people themselves, so that the people of Beemore, who are these workers who from cradle to grave have a pretty decent life and a sort of pleasant existence, they don't have lots of freedoms, but they don't. Who needs freedom when you have a full belly in the evening and you're some kin around you? And I guess the question there for me was, what are these, what is keeping these people from rebelling or leaving? Mm-hmm. And that's what initiates the kind of general, the anxiety of the story at the start of the book, which is, why would Fan ever leave? Why would you leave this place that in which it's, you have a modicum of, sort of a decent kind of existence, and that was, part of my, I suppose, again, questioning of a certain kind of community, in some ways a certain kind of Asian inflected community, because it brought up some anxieties for me about that. In some ways, this is, I always like to say, it's my most Asian American book in a way. I don't consider my other books that, because those books are, following distinctive singular people. Mm-hmm. But this is the we.
Right. Right.
I mean, this is the we, this is it, mm-hmm. And so it brings up, for me, I guess I went through a lot of, my kind of notions and worries about us.
Mm-hmm.
But in talking about, class rigidity. Yeah, I mean, it's a society in which everyone has, and this is the scary part of it. It's not so much that there's not very little mobility. There is very little mobility, but what's scary about the book for me, as I wrote it, and what I began to realize about it, is that all these people are so accepting of their lot.
Right.
They've ceased to understand that mobility is something that you'd want,
mm-hmm.
for various reasons, sometimes out of fear, sometimes out of, right.
Right.
But, and that's what I guess what I meant by it's now insinuated itself, mm-hmm. into the very fabric of their consciousness and spirituality.
The barriers are psychological.
Yes.
Almost spiritual. You're not going to encounter it on a day-to-day basis. You won't even be conscious of it anymore.
Not even conscious of it,
yeah.
Right. So, maybe now we're conscious of class difference,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, we have to be. But I suppose one of my thoughts was, if we just extrapolate out how we're going, maybe at some point, no, we'll all be walled off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, I think, the death of society.
Mm-hmm. Especially, and so this might be a non-contrived way to just briefly recap the kind of synopsis for those of you who haven't read it yet. Beemore is, and sorry if I'm repeating anything Maureen said, Beemore is the essentially the middle class that, at the risk of being reductive, is kind of a working middle class where food and services are provided for the upper class, where people live in what are called charter villages, and these are people who have.
Well, they're the 0.1%.
They're the privileged.
Yeah.
And then at the bottom, there are the open counties, which is really not a structured part of society, is essentially it's lawless, I guess, to some extent.
It's everything-less.
Everything-less, yeah. Right.
There's
right.
no infrastructure, there's no governance, there's no nothing. And that, again, is, you know, part of, it's not just the fact that it's that way and unfortunate, it's that no one cares that it's that way.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what, you know, I'm just sort of wrestling with. It's definitely because I feel like I live in a charter village. We mm-hmm. you know, if we're lucky, we do live in charter villages. Mm-hmm. Many of us who have, you know, some education mm-hmm. and means and can move about and who are in command of our destinies mm-hmm. in a certain way. But I guess some of that command, some of that sense of power, some of the sense of control, I think could infect us too. And say, you know what? People have their own destinies. We don't have to do anything. You know, we do a little bit. We don't have to do much more. So that's, and I think that's when, you know, we get into trouble.
Right.
You know, all of us.
Yeah. That interesting, right? And so it was. It is a bit reductive to call, you know, BMOR or the facility, the places where the facilities are middle class, because there are elements.
There's really no middle class right. in the book. I mean, they're more just service people.
They're service people, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't line up exactly with that. There are aspects of it, and to that point, for instance, one of the great, you know, sort of. Sort of smaller points in the book, but I think. Is one of those perfect moments where it's really crystallized, is to get from a place like BMOR into a charter village to become chartered, you have to score in the top, I think it's 2% of, every year, I think after you turn 12, you can promote up, essentially, in this society. But you don't just have to score in the top 2% of BMOR, you have to score in the top 2% of the charters. You have to basically be better than almost every charter just to move up. You teach at Princeton. And it had a lot of resonance too. I mean, I've read a lot of articles recently about the Ivy League and about people arguing cogently on both sides, whether or not, you know, this system is essentially just rigidly stratifying, accelerating the stratification of society.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the bit in the book is all about this crazed, you know, program of achievement.
Right.
For what? Mm. Right. I mean, yes, the slots are few. So mathematically, yes, you have to have that kind of, you know, zealotry mm-hmm. in going for, you know, your top scores. But and again, that's just sort of a critique of mine of just the way that we've all become. And looking at those kinds of markers and those kinds of measures rather than something much more meaningful. So at Princeton, of course, yeah, I mean, you know, whatever, 6% of the kids get in and 85% of the applicants would do perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. That's a numbers game, but what can Princeton do about it? Nothing. But it's part of a larger kind. It's a symptom of a larger situation in our society, which is we feel absolutely desperate to get one of those slots, because if you don't get one of those slots, somehow you're relegated to some other kind of existence. Not Princeton or nothing, but college or maybe nothing. Right, or something like so. There's not enough opportunity,
right?
Generally,
right.
And this is the very top of the sort of, you know, the rarefied point of lacking opportunity. But really, it's a symptom of a larger problem. We're not taking care of the means for people to have meaningful existences. That are, you know, noble and prosperous in the ways that people deserve. Mm. So,
we see that a little bit in the book. We see characters who, you know, I'll keep it anonymous to not spoil it. But we see, you know, a major character who essentially has fallen a couple of classes. Well, we find out in the story of the character that there is downward movement. I mean, in general, it's much easier to move down than up, obviously.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to move up, and it's pretty easy to move down.
Very
existence
easy
is pretty contingent, yeah. And I thought that was, you know, that in the book, it comes from a kind of economic macro forces that destroy this person's livelihood. There's also in the book that, you know, a disease called C, which capital C, which is the focus of much energy sort of in this society in eradicating C.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about C and how it...
C is sort of this all-encompassing, inevitable disease that everyone gets. Hmm. You know, C is everywhere. It's in the air. And as I said, it's inevitable that you will die from it, if mm-hmm. not from some accident mm-hmm. before that. It will kill you. And I suppose it stands for cancer in a certain way. But a cancer that's truly a cancer mm-hmm. in the entire society. And that is, you know, woven in the strands of every person's makeup. Except, of course, Fan's boyfriend, mm-hmm. Who is purported not to have any C susceptibility. And I guess that part of that little thing, and I don't make a huge, thing about it in terms of it, the environmental issues, but that's another one of the kind of anxieties that I had about this society, that mm-hmm. that it's not just, of course, a natural environmental disaster, but that the environmental disaster, again, has been ingrained into us. It's almost psychological. Mm-hmm. Just the same way that these people are, that the charters are so into achievement.
Right.
They have no other modality. And they live for that modality. And at the end of it, what is there? Mm-hmm. And once they stop being successful at that modality is when disaster can strike.
There's a kind of instability to...
It's a very fragile world mm-hmm. in every one of those sectors. And I think that's, again, something that I didn't really know at the beginning of the writing, but I came to understand.
Yeah, I mean, that's super scary. It's a super scary future. I mean, as you know, I don't know if I'd call it hopeful, but there are elements in the story that are not, that give reason to think that there's, well, let's focus on the scary part.
Well, the hopeful part, I don't think is that apparent.
Yeah.
But, I think the end of the book is somewhat hopeful in that, and maybe it's not about what's happening in the world that is depicted, but more about this we again, going back to the narrator, because really the story is all about this we finding out about the larger world and finding out about all the possibilities mm-hmm. for a certain kind of destiny, and I think that even despite all the trials and tribulations that Fan goes through, I think at the end the we begins to understand, yeah, we are able to tell this story, we're able to sort of, take it all in, and we're still, I guess, okay. And maybe we have a little bit more knowledge now, and maybe that knowledge is, again, it's I guess the hope of an active, a more active and more vital imagination that the we has. So.
Yeah, the we has that function of being kind of eerie and spooky and collective, and then yet that same kind of choral nature of the voice can sometimes lift into something.
It tries to lift.
Yeah. And as it searches for this story, and you just mentioned that as Fan kind of searches out each possibility. That's one interesting thing about her kind of odyssey, which it's very interesting to hear you describe that you actually sat down and weren't sure where Fan might go next, because one of the things that I wanted to talk about was the oddly kind of not passive, because to describe her as passive would be very misleading. She seems almost like a vector of destiny. Like she's out there, or the we is telling this story as our hero Fan, our mythical hero Fan, is going out into the world. And yet she seems to be sometimes carried along by the sea, yeah, by fate.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, she's, in some ways, she's very modest. She's often powerless.
Mm-hmm.
I think what she does have is a certain kind of elemental presence that the people in the novel, I think everyone in the novel that she encounters is so wanting or lacking or desperate for some kind of meaning or some kind of path. And it seems to them, I think whenever they meet Fan, they think she knows what she, there's something about her that's so solid in a way, even if modest. And I think that's why she can be sort of passive and yet draw this energy. She's sort of like a magnet. And sometimes a magnet, often a magnet for malice. People act and project upon her things. But that's the sort of, very definitely, and wanted her and wanted this hero, and the hero of this novel, not to be the typical hero, where she would be the one who would be the philosophizer. She wouldn't be the one who was, really doing too much swashbuckling. She wasn't going to be the one who was going to politically lead peoples to some kind of new order. She's more a mirror of what they want and all the people that she meets. I thought to myself when I was, really deciding to write it this way, that like, this could be a disaster. People, I'm writing the main character is not actually, we don't really know anything about her. She doesn't really have any opinions. She doesn't have, she has sensations, fear, hunger, all that. But then I thought that, it maybe be fun to try to write a novel like that, where all the energy and all the sort of psychological import was somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For me in reading it, it something did click fairly early on, as I, you go through kind of the early chapters and feel that nature of Fan and feel that something is, seems to be a vessel or a stand-in almost. It's just some kind of, something not quite individualized about her. And then something clicked relatively early on that led me to understand how to read it, I think, from the perspective that you're describing. In a way also, and this is a stretch, so just tell me if this is stupid, but she felt like almost an idealized version of June Singer. I mean, that's terrible, but she felt to me, it could just be like because this shows a haircut that I imagine June's haircut looked. It's probably just that. So, but she felt in that she was like, had a gem-like hardness about her. But Fan isn't quite gem-like hard. I don't know.
But there is something that's very sturdy about her, even though she's small and young and not so powerful. There's a solidity there that I, and again, something natural. I always thought of her more as like a tree than anything, a lovely little tree that you couldn't help but be attracted to. Some of the people in the book want to cut down that tree.
Right.
Deforest it, but that's how I saw it.
And she's a child, really. I mean, she's described as she's 16, I believe, but she's described looking like 11 or 12 years old.
Right. And again, I wanted her to not be passive. that I agree. That's not quite the right word, but not the main actor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, no. I mean, I think that comes through quite clearly. And sorry if I use the word passive, but it's. I think that would detract just from a pure craft level. I love that. It works nicely with the we, because it keeps the focus on her being too sort of strongly in control of her own fate, even though in the individual moment she seems to, you know, often take very drastic action as necessary. But at certain key moments, she is carried along, and at times it seems like it's just by bad luck or good luck. And then the we kind of comes into this forefront.
Right. And she's, you know, and that's where sort of the title of the book comes about, and, you know, the sense of her being, you know, taken on this tide of waters, you know, here and there, and sometimes for, you know, in happiness and sometimes in misery. But she's always able to ride it out, whereas everyone else in the book is always struggling in that water.
At one point in the book, there is a bit of a sort of a rebellion of sorts, which I thought was such a lively scene, and yet it kind of goes down as quickly as it rises up.
Right. Yeah, it's the people of Beemore, you know, all these very compliant, you know, well-behaved people. They do begin to rebel, you know. And there's some. I had a little fun with that. You know, they don't know how to rebel, really. You know, so they start throwing like their food wrappers in the lake.
Right.
You know, or but it gets more serious. They start drawing little murals of Fan and Reg, and some of them cut their own hair all off.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a society in which they have no legacy and no history and knowledge of how one might rebel.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to figure it out as it goes along. They know that something's not right, but they don't yet have the language. By which, in language, I'm using that word broadly, by which they can express themselves. And of course, it does die down. And I think that's the sad part of it. But I hope that there was a suggestion that maybe this is the first round.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that comes through.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure. And I think that's part of the hope, just that moment. I think it's... I think it's also, to me, an indication, or not an indication, but it touches on something we talked about earlier, in that life isn't that bad in Beemore. And that's one thing that I really love about this, and I think goes to the complexity with describing this as a dystopia, in that this isn't some, I think, unless you tell me I'm wrong, but...
It's not some minims, you know, it's not a prison.
Right.
But it's... You know, people have asked me, you know, what is the real inspiration for Beemore? And I think it's, you know, it's sort of like Singapore. Have you ever been to Singapore?
Okay.
I mean, Singapore is a really nice place to visit.
Yeah.
You know, the food's great and it's clean and people are pretty happy. You know, it's all about commerce, pretty good service everywhere you go. But of course, there are strictures, seen and unseen. And there are rebellions. There's resistance, but it's quiet resistance. It has to be, because the consequences are pretty serious. So I guess my question for a society like that, because in some ways Singapore is ideal.
Yeah.
But in other ways it's also. It's also a little frightening for, you know, if you think about all the days put together, any one day in a place like that's great. but he put them all together, and then some other kind of, and when you start to project out about destiny, a future, mm-hmm. you know, imagination about what could be, then that's when it gets scary, you know. And I think that's what, for me, is the scariest part of any place, which is if you can't imagine that it would ever change, mm-hmm. no matter how good it is, that's a little scary.
Right.
Because then something about some spontaneity, some vitality, I think, has been lost.
I want to ask you one more follow-up question on that. And I think after that, maybe we'll take questions from the audience. So prepare your minds, or prepare your questions if they're already prepared. So on that note, and I'm trying to maybe end on a slightly more hopeful note. I don't know why, but
we don't need to be hopeful.
Because I just bummed everyone. Exactly. Okay, good. We're done. At one point, I've said no spoilers, but I probably spoiled several things. But here's another one. At one point, there's a character in the Charters who talks about almost a nostalgia for places like more specifically, right. Because, and again, this goes for me the negative sort of, not the negative, but the kind of resistance from an easy pat answer to what the society is or feels like. And again, it adds to the resonance for this book to, you know, existence in this America, for me anyway, because they talk about Beemor almost as if it's some place to miss. Here are these people that live, and these are especially rich people who live in the Charters, and yet they want to essentially recreate some of the more beautiful aspects of a place like Beemor.
Right, the intimacy, the kinship, you know, the grubby human stuff that's been, you know, kind of, you know, washed out of Charter life. You know, Charter life is so wonderful. Charter life, you know, Charter life is so wonderful and spick and span and luxurious, but a human taint. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, again, that's part of what they're missing, mm-hmm. you know, in all their glory.
Yeah, I mean, that's as hopeful a note. Grubby human stuff is about as hopeful as we'll get, but that's pretty hopeful for me. I don't know how we take questions. I guess we could probably hear, but
yeah,
unless...
I think we can hear, and we can yell.
I was wondering if there were any other authors who have written in the second person that you reacted to either, oh, I can do that so much better, or, wow, I wonder if I can do that and what would happen. And I'm thinking specifically of Stephen Milhauser's many short stories in the second person and your reaction to those.
It's actually first person.
I'm sorry, in the plural narrative. And I'm also wondering what other authors are out there who've done that I'm not aware of.
Right. Well, Stephen Milhauser is a wonderful example. I mean, and you should read Stephen Milhauser's stories. They're wonderfully fantastical, but also very, you know, they're both fantastical, but also very concrete. He's someone that I've always admired and came to rather late. I had the pleasure of meeting him in the fall, and one of, you know, he wrote this wonderful story called The Slap. I don't know if you know that story called The Slap. And it's this crazy story about this community. And usually, of course, his stories are all in about a little community in which there's a serial slapper, some guy who goes around, emerges from the shadows, and slaps you. Hard enough that you remember and you're really taken aback, but not hard enough to harm you. And so this little community, and I always imagine it as like this little Westchester, New York town or something like that with a train station. He slaps, you know, about six or seven different people, and it's like this, you know, this whole, it initiates this this incredible kind of sickness in the town. They're like wondering, why is our town being slapped? What have we done? And so it's a wonderful example of the we, because it's a story in which, of course, there are individual characters, but the narrator who's commenting upon this does collect everyone's anxieties and goes through them and catalogs them for the story. And so it becomes this sort of concert of worry. And you can't ever just relegate it to, oh, this is that one crazy person who thinks this. There's this kind of imprint upon the entire world, not just of that town, but of the whole world, of the universe of that holds that whole story. So it's kind of a haunting story, even though it's very funny, but also very, 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 very serious at the same time. So yeah, I mean, I don't think I could ever better Stephen Milhouse here. But what I did wonder about was using the we was, you know, for a short story, yeah, but can a novel sustain that whole thing? And I think we talked about the ways in which I found that I had to vary the knowledge, the reach, the voicing even of the we so that it wouldn't be monolithic, because it wasn't just one moment. It was this whole series of moments. And there have been, you know, the two of the ones, novels that I know are my colleague and good friend Jeffrey Eugenides, The Virgin Suicides, is told in the we. That's a wonderful book. And also the Joshua Ferris novel.
And Then We Came to the End.
Yeah, And Then We Came to the End. It's sort of an office novel, mm-hmm. right? And again, those are chosen because one's an office and then one's the boys in that town. And the function is slightly different, I mm-hmm. think, than in mine.
This is a very big we.
Those are tighter wees.
Yeah.
mine's a baggy, loose wee.
Well, I think that's a characteristic, well, I don't know, characteristic, I just met you, but it seems to be a very characteristically humble way of describing what I think is a real innovation in your we, which is that it's not a cheat to change your we, because we can be a lot of things.
Yeah, yeah.
At any given moment, some of the we goes to the bathroom, and
right,
so there's
right.
other we is, you know, speaking louder at different points,
right,
and
right.
then we changes. It's
yep.
lots of people, so
yep.
it's unreliable first-person plural, maybe. Not unreliable, but...
Yeah, but it is unreliable.
Yeah.
It is unreliable. Yeah.
Next question, right up here.
Thank you so much for your book. I really loved it. I actually listened to it. I thought B.D. Wong was a perfect voice for it, too, by the way. I wonder, I know you don't want to talk about spoilers, but I wonder if I could ask a question about keeping.
About what?
Keeping in the book.
Oh, keeping.
In the charters.
Keeping. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So the part I was most shocked, and what you were saying earlier about how we live in charters today, I completely felt that. It was reality today in a lot of ways. And that leads to my question. The part I was most, the one line I was most shocked by in the entire book was... I think one of the characters was saying, well, you could always keep, and I'm not going to ruin what that is for folks, unless you'd like to. And then the response is something like, ew, don't be icky. Right. And is that just the most amount of moral outrage she could muster? Why is that such a resonant line?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think you got it right there. I mean, you know, there's not this whole philosophical debate about it, right? It's just, it's something that is yicky, but that's as much, that's as far as anyone can go in the charters. I mean, all the charters are, they sort of have their own morality that they carry around with them. And we all do, of course. But they've taken it to the nth degree, where morality is really about your fetishes, right? Your desire, your more grotesque, the more grotesque sides of you know, your nature. And why is that in the charters? Just because they're bored. There's nothing else to do. They have to look inward and inward and inward and inward. And the deeper you go and the longer you obsess, it starts to turn, you know, kind of rancid. So, yeah.
I was interested in how you said that there were not walls between these groups. And I was interested in the self-policing that they did, the stories they told themselves that would reinforce their ethics, their morals.
Yeah.
And so the when they talk about the artifacts in the historical museum.
Yes.
And can I read you a real quick quote that I'd like you to expand on? It was, okay. It says, we have grown up now, generations deep, generations strong, and have we not lasted long enough to dare say all the hopes of our forebears have come true? Have we not done the job of becoming our best selves?
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting. Could you talk a little bit more about the self?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the idea behind that passage is, you know, we've done our good work here. You know, we've fulfilled the expectation of our function, and you know, we're in that way we're a wonderful machine, and I guess they're asking it, of course, rhetorically. You know, yes, we have, but the next beat is, then what? Now what? And it's, you know, it's, I think that's, this is a story really of, it's also kind of a, for me, it was a coming of age story for the we. You know, it's a we that is, you know, has had the only lore it's had has already been satisfied, which is dysfunction. But now that there's something else that has to be kind of, you know, recognized. Yeah.
I was wondering why you chose to have the female as your main character and main individual character, aside from the we, and if you think it would have made a difference had it been a male character.
Could you have written the same book?
Could I have written the same book? Well, no, it wouldn't have been the same book. It's slightly different. But I don't know how it would have been different. I definitely wanted someone who was young, and I knew that, and small, and I knew that. I think, though, and part of this is probably just just a personal thing, is that, you know, I have two daughters, and I guess I'd always, you know, in some ways, I wrote this book for them. You know, I wrote this book for you know, innocents who would look upon the world and have to go through it. So that's probably where I should became a girl rather than a boy.
Really quick. As your daughter enrolls in college, are you dealing with the prospect that the likelihood that she'll someday read her dad's work?
Yeah. Her friends have, a lot of her friends have, but she's, you know, it's too weird for her to do it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant as assigned reading.
Yeah.
It's
too weird for her, so.
Hi, I'm curious about the significance of water in your work. Obviously, there's the aquarium in this book, but I was reminded also of A Gesture Life,
yes.
How there's a lot, you know, about Doc Hodda's swimming pool and his routine and the way that mirrored, you know, how...
There's a lot in The Surrender, too, actually.
Right. I read Just Your Life last year and loved it. It was the best thing. But I was just wondering sort of where that started for you.
I don't know. I mean, I guess there's something about it. It's one of those, you know, unexplainable things. You know, maybe I used to be afraid of the water. Now I love the water. You know, I go to Hawaii as often as I can. I love bodyboarding and surfing and... But there's something about the water that speaks to me, I guess, you know, and if whether that's the sea or just, you know, like a dark lake, because it's so you know, right there, you know, it's not like the air that you have to go up in a contraption, you know, we can really get into it and it envelops you and you can, and I think as Fan says, you can believe that you're one with it, but of course you're not, and there's something about that. You know, that false promise of it that I kind of like. And it's also a place of hiding. In Gesture Life, it's where he hides. It's also, you know, a comfort. So So the water, you know, as we all know, it's where we all come from. And but metaphorically too, it just it seems to me like the perfect medium. Yeah.
I wanted to say thank you for writing such a sprawling and intimate novel at the same time. It was really captivating.
Thank you.
I was fascinated by the conflict between the we, the collective, the limitations of community, versus how in the charters everyone seems to be living for themselves.
Oh, there, that's an I culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And while I was reading it, I was searching for sort of that, where's the happy medium? And I guess maybe perhaps Fan is searching for that also. I was wondering if you could speak to that and where you think that happy medium may lie.
Well, there's a problem with the, there's absolutely a problem with this all-encompassing we, right? I mean, and it's always, for me, and I don't know if this is cultural, but, you know, not a conflict, but just a kind of wrestling between independence and interdependence. You know, growing up in an Asian household or Asian-inflected household, you know, interdependence is valued, maybe more than in other parts of the world or other kinds of traditions. And yet, of course, I myself have been raised outside that home in a completely independent, you know, supreme and lauded kind of culture. And I think, you know, both obviously, I don't know what the, I'm not sure what the happy medium is. I do know that that I feel frustrated by both. And I don't know, and I think it's hard to know how one is their true self, given those two tuggings. And maybe I'm not the one to ever know it. You know, maybe I'm always going to be between that, and maybe others, I have a more natural kind of, you know, position on it, both personally, culturally, intellectually. But it's something that I think is worth thinking about, and because I'm always, you know, feeling guilty about both. Like I'm feeling guilty when it's all about me, and then I'm also feeling kind of angry and frustrated and sometimes guilty that when you know it's when I feel like I'm I don't know not as apparent as I think I should be but I guess it's all about the kind of society you want. I tend to think that we in this society, in this Western society, have not explored the positives and the all the beauties of interdependence. And maybe we're going back towards that way because we feel isolated, because we feel like at the end of the day we don't have that taint of others, you know. But I struggle with it too. Yeah.
Well, I think that's our...
That's it?
On that note, I want to thank the Library Foundation and the wonderful staff, and thank you, Chang Rai Lee, for
thanks
this
a lot, Charlie.
Wonderful.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.